The three big games earlier this year, you know, you have Pal World, you have Bit Battle, and you have, I don't know, Lethal Company. Like, these are all small teams that were doing something that's sort of like not aiming directly at the pack. And so oftentimes think like, if you're digging where no one's digging, you can have small teams. You can dig actually pretty shallow to find and strike gold. But if you were to go and dig where someone's already dug, you have to dig way deeper. So you have to have a lot more people, a lot more resources, right? If you wanted to make GTA, guess what? GTA has 1,300 people. Go and try to compete with them. Like, good luck, right? You need an army.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the sixth episode of All Chat, a podcast where we're aiming to deliver an unfiltered view behind the scenes of some of the most interesting and current topics within the gaming industry, startups more broadly, and venture capital. Today, we will be discussing emerging topics stemming from the recent Game Developers Conference held earlier this March in San Francisco. Clear that our industry is undergoing a time of change. Incumbent powers continue to redefine priorities as they shape their teams to tackle future opportunities. Well-funded startups are looking ahead to imminent product launches, and new upstarts are looking to build and deliver new hit games. On top of all of these comes an exciting array of new technologies which appear to enable much more time and cost-efficient development, which can be an advantage both for large and small companies alike. We will also look forward at some of the new games we are most excited to play and existing games we are excited to see further evolve. I'm excited to be joined today by my good friends and former colleagues Thomas Vu, previously head of creative at Riot Games and the executive producer of Arcane, Steven Lin, who was previously the executive producer of Valorant and now co-founder of Raidbase. And finally, there's Brian and myself, partners at Patreon, a venture firm leading seed rounds across consumer and gaming startups. Now let's dive into our discussion about emerging industry trends coming out of GDC. So yeah, I guess like we're excited to dive into some thoughts coming out of GDC and try to look forward at what are some exciting things happening in the game space. So I guess kick it off to you guys on what you guys want to start.
A lot of my travels, because we didn't have a specific goal this particular GDC, unlike all the prior ones in the less recent years, we were mostly catching up with fellow like startups. Of course, some potential investors that we want to keep building a relationship with, and trying to, I guess, assess or grok like all those conversations and to process them to figure out, you know, what can meaningfully do, how things play into like short and long term strategies for our own startups, let alone like all the startups that we're friendly with. For me, at least in the groups that I talked to, there was a lot of people looking for their next round of funding, and a pretty unanimous like difficulty in that right now. It's been hard to navigate. It's been hard to stand out. It's been hard to get attention, and ultimately, you know, a lot of founders are pinched between those realities and then their teams and what to do next. So I think that is, if any of you are out there like feeling that, I don't know if this is helpful. Hopefully it is, but you're not alone. And I think collectively there's a very strong desire from everyone who's invested in this, from founders to larger companies to publishers to VCs, who all want things to work for all these like ventures. So there's a lot of alignment in that too. And I think a lot of people are very invested in seeing successes here. So that's like another takeaway that I saw a lot of energy, a lot of brain power going toward this. I think a lot of funds are raising their next rounds, and generally seemingly positive sentiment on those prospects, which maybe allude to better prospects on the hopefully like the near to mid horizon for all the startups seeking funding. Now, so I'm curious to hear if you guys had similar or different experiences there. And yeah, maybe we can start there to see what did we even see. We spend most of our time talking with other startups and trying to be helpful, basically.
Yeah, I think it depends on what stage you're at. I think certainly, as you described, Slim, like the venture stage, obviously like growth. And this isn't just, I don't think, tied to gaming startups. I think it's actually all of a lot of startups out there, right, that are seeking capital. It certainly has been a lot harder than, let's compare it to like 21, 22. I think from our side, like because we invest primarily at seed and pre-seed, we've actually seen a lot of optimism as it relates to new founders, new startups. I mean, it's definitely a different mentality, right? I think a lot of founders that are starting today, they're coming from a place of like scarcity and making sure that they can hit like the right numbers. I think it's probably one of the best times to start a company as it relates to talent availability. Like the amount of people willing to look for new roles and, you know, kind of think about what's around the corner as it relates to startup opportunities. Like it's a lot bigger. It's almost like, I don't know how you guys felt about GDC this year, but it certainly felt like there were like almost like multiple GDCs, like depending on who you spoke to, like, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right about the pre-seed stage. I mean, with speed runs, timing and everything, there was like a lot of awesome teams that we met. Like they started off strong and this batch is even stronger. A lot of exciting things out there. I saw less in the form of content, but a lot, you know, leveraging AI for various applications, but a lot of like really inventive young teams out there.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree largely what you said. I think a lot of the sort of challenges in the sort of funding market is obviously we have like high interest. And so capital has a lot of safe places to go, right? And, you know, obviously with VC, it's inherently like a high risk, high reward sort of mechanism. And so, but I what I saw, you know, in the sort of mid tier, second round, third round companies looked actually somewhat promising, because the ones that are doing something truly unique and stand out are still getting interest, you know. And I think that's the only thing I would add is that if your game is very differentiated, and it feels like there's this like shift towards actually more blue ocean sort of opportunities versus like let's go tackle an existing market that's like deep red, those games I've noticed have stood out. And I think established teams with established track records are also getting good traction. So yes, it's scary, but I think it's causing a lot of people to, I think founders think twice about what they want to make, you know, versus like, I think previous years it felt like there's this hot thing, we're going to go fast, we're going to hit this market. And now it's like, hey, games take time. Let's really think through what we're going to do if this is going to be for the long run. And so I think the sort of thoughtfulness and sort of game sense making is better. Articulation of like what people are trying to make is better. I think having sort of any sort of advantages around like publishing, relationships, affiliation, all those things actually sort of what I would describe as the intangibles actually matter a lot more. And so I saw like, obviously it's brutal, so I don't want to make light of it. But at the same time, there's still capital waiting to find interesting projects, getting match made with interesting projects.
And there's a whole concept about like constraints that, you know, are given with startups. I think they're always a given no matter what, where you are, and you should always be aware of them. And people talk about constraints in the negative for many obvious reasons, but I think a lot of really great things come out because of constraints, because they kind of force you in a really ambiguous like venture in the prospect of making content for a game that I can relate to more, where like it's harder to judge objectively until way after the fact. To help you know even that you're moving forward versus backward versus sideways. I think constraints can be really useful for that. And to your point, Thomas, like I think it's anything that encourages, even if right now a lot of this can feel bad, I think anything that drives more thoughtfulness around product will be on average better for all of us, from everyone too. So if we can each take the opportunity to like basically focus on what the product really needs to be versus an opportunity that may or may not be there by the time we release, then I think that is more durable in general.
Yeah, I would also argue like venture capital was never like a bottleneck for great companies to get built. Maybe that's one way to think about it. Because if you guys think about like even 2008, you know, there, I mean, that was like one of my first GDCs, you know, this is almost like 15 plus years ago. That was like a brutal time, right? There certainly wasn't a lot of VCs like investing into startups. Maybe there were like a handful that were like doing it as like not a core thing. But I guess in the last 15 years, like all these funds got created and certainly there's a lot more money. But I think just going back to like the original point, it's really about like building businesses, and it doesn't really matter at the end of the day how much money you raise unless you build like a great company, right? Or a great product at the end of the day. So I guess like one question I want to ask you guys, given I think one of the topics certainly has been around sustainability. And, you know, we've seen a lot of like these rise of indie studios, like the fact that Palworld got created off of a very small team and not a lot of funding, I think just kind of speaks to like the opportunities of like small teams. And maybe it's not a venture fundable team, but still like it's just a great team, right? In terms of like the great outcome. So how do you guys think about like the rise of indie studios? And like, do you actually think the cost of creating games is going to go down significantly with what we're seeing with like, with a lot of the AI tools and even like, you know, the GitHub Copilot as an example, right? I'm sure a lot of game developers on it. Like, do you foresee the cost actually going down significantly, or is that something that is years out given like where we're at with the technology? I think this is one of the topics that we talked about a lot during GDC.
I think this trend has already been happening even without AI. I think it'll be accelerated through all the efforts in AI. But if you looked at just even the ubiquity of both Unity and Unreal, that alone, in addition to, you know, Roblox and other mod tools, like that desire has been there to use things like that. People even mod things without even official tool support. And as those tools got better and better, as they had more rigor and usage and support and YouTube videos and like forum posts and all the things that contribute to education of how to use those tools, we have had this new renaissance of like, we like almost came back full circle to where like small teams can make games again. And a lot of AAA teams that have only expanded, like I feel like a lot of the teams got used to growing as like the only way out, the only way to compete, didn't even really notice that this renaissance has been happening. You know, minus obviously Steam that like sees it firsthand and has only seen its like number of games grow and stuff like that on its platform. But yeah, like, you know, if we look back the last 5-10 years, you know, you look at Valheim with 5 people and, you know, PUBG, I think there were 20 people initially, I think.
League was pretty small too, right? It's not like
League was, yeah. As the tools have gotten better, I think this can only be more true, because I think the cap has been a lot of friction. Not that it was ever impossible, but like, you know, it went to like the most hardcore people or people who didn't know any better to like bust past that. And then now I think that bar has been lowering. And so more people are trying. I think that will generally encourage more people to invent within it. And and by not having such a big ask, the stakes get lowered on like the outcome too. So like if we had the context switch that like Blizzard made Palworld, people would react probably very differently to that situation versus like the sentence of a team that made Craftopia before spent $7 million and then they had whatever hundreds of millions in outcome sounds like ridiculously positive. I mean, it's like by almost any measure you can look at it, that situation was a success for that team. You know, there's a lot of criticisms about it and everything, but at the end of the day, they freaking won. And it's awesome. I find it encouraging that there are examples like that. And that there have been, I can think only an increasing amount of that, in the past years, hopefully further accelerated by, AI and other tools, but not like dependent on it. It's already been happening. Even, you know, even before all these AI tools, it's been accelerating on its own. And I think a lot of that had to do with just the ubiquity of like education and information on how to make a game. And then more people just like, you know, I'm just a person anyway. I need to make a demo to get a job and I'll just make this thing. And then, oops, it like was successful. And then boom, Stardew Valley. I'm obviously oversimplifying that, but like this has been happening already. And I love that. And I love that it's been happening because I think for a lot of us who've been part of like bigger efforts, call it AAA or not, I think having these examples to challenge how we think is absolutely part of what's liberating and inspiring about our industry. But I think it behooves us to actually stop and pay attention to it and to think about, reassess like what we're doing and our approach. Of course, it's natural for us to lean on what worked for us before, but I think, I don't know, I'll speak for myself. I personally have this outlook that our target is a moving target. If we are oriented around serving players, players are getting influenced constantly. You know, there are these huge changes. Like, you know, you look back at like how games were made before and after, like people had the ubiquity of smartphone. And then there's various like other new habits and practices and the ubiquity of information and how fast it spreads these days that is influencing like how people are even willing to like look at a traditional cinematic. You know, before that was like a new thing, and seeing like, you know, your World of Warcraft characters fully rendered in like the Blizzard cinematic fashion was like mind-blowing in 2004 and before and after that. And now like there's so many like blur level videos that I'm like, I can't even be bothered to look at for like the 2 minutes that they are, because there's like 30 of them in a day. You're just like, eventually you don't look at them, all of them. And I certainly don't think they resonate as much as they used to. So where are those new frontiers that get us excited as players and as developers? Can we do things smaller to reduce the stakes to where it's not as scary to make certain committal decisions? And have this a worry about like stakes going so high that you would think that would be inspiring to people, but instead I think I see more commonly a contraction of risk taking. And so I think there's more pressure for a thing to succeed, and in so doing you're like making these safer decisions that actually I think undermine the prospect of that aspiration or that inspiration. And so I think seeing these examples are moments to like stop and like, do we really need to like pump it up to be this? When's the last time? I mean, clearly players are responding to things that aren't like full AAA quality, more so than a lot of games that have it and then are dead within like a week. And so I think we need to like reassess that traditional approach and application of some of our experiences or capabilities to like, just because we can push graphics, like, should we? Is that actually more meaningful to the experience and immersion than frame rate? Or like a bunch of these other things that I think are pretty nuanced conversations, but are worth assessing, because again, there's like a lot of things that clearly have not impacted, by scaling them back, have not impacted like the reception. In fact, maybe even have boosted it because expectations weren't as high or whatever. So
I kind of like that startups are also able to take more than one shot on goal. I mean, if you guys think about even like the story of PUBG, right? Like that certainly wasn't Blue Hole's, before it became Krafton, it wasn't their first shot on goal. Like they took many years to get to PUBG, and maybe like Riot was an outlier where, you know, their first game just like really hit it out of the ballpark. But I think you bring up a good point, which is like, it's actually good for startups to experiment before they're able to like double down and find like a PUBG or a League and just like start scaling. And maybe in the future, like maybe you don't need to scale that much, right? I think the way we think about it is like the cost of creating a gaming studio is actually going to go down a lot more. Therefore, it's not as capital intensive, but it also means that it allows like more shots on goals. I think like maybe one area, and you guys again are probably deeper in development than we are, but one area that I think could change a lot is like prototyping, you know, like building kind of like a scaffolding or like some sort of like a skeleton to be able to like prove out gameplay and like build interesting products. That seems just a lot more accessible now with like what's happening with AI and a lot of the tooling available. So I don't know.
I mean, you look at the like overnight success of Power World.
Yeah.
It's like 8 years in the making, right? Didn't they start in 2016 or something?
It wasn't.
And I'm aware of Craftopia. Maybe they had other games too. I think they had other games.
Actually met up with Takahashi over at Power World. while I was at GDC. We had a really amazing breakfast, and we sort of talked about some of this and where they're going. But what's, you know, to your original question around, like, are things getting cheaper? Yes, to an extent. So, you know, all the examples that Slim gave is definitely true. But if you look at all of them, and you can go all the way back to like Notch at Minecraft, right? Like that little team that made like a $1 billion product. Those experiences tend to be tend to have zero competition because they were so out there. So you look at a lot of these games that have sort of these small teams sort of went and took a much more risky sort of trajectory to do something that was, let's call it, a little bit out there. And if you look at actually the three big games this year, earlier this year, you know, you have Pow World, you have BitBattle, and you have, I don't know, Lethal Company. Like, these are all small teams that were doing something that's sort of like not aiming directly at the pack. And so I also oftentimes think, like, if you're digging where no one's digging, you can have small teams. You can have a small group of people, and you can dig actually pretty shallow to find and strike gold. But if you were to go and dig where someone's already dug, you have to dig way deeper. So you have to have a lot more people, a lot more resources, right? And so if you wanted to make GTA, guess what? GTA has 1,300 people. GTA 6 has 1,300 people, right? Like, go and try to compete with them. Like, good luck, right? You need an army. And so I think engines have made the prototyping process easier. But where I think it's going to be really unique is that, and this is actually probably not as widely known, is that AI is already making things faster and cheaper, but it's not, you're going to start to see many teams do this and not tell anybody what they're doing. So just think of it like this. Everything that you see, like from a generative perspective that's announced, is going to very quickly be erased to the bottom. That means everybody's going to get it. Very soon, what you're going to see is specialized models that are very unique and specific and game specific, custom made to make certain things, and that are not shared. You will not even know. It will not even be talked about. And there are things that I'm aware of at GDC that really, I mean, I'm very confident that there will be small teams of 10 to 20 people that will make $1 billion products, like, because of this. But it's all very bespoke, and it's not going to be talked about. It's seldom going to be, it's going to be talked about like, oh yeah, we did this thing with AI, and what, they won't tell you. It's because it's now, I think, at the highest level of making games, it's going to be a competitive advantage. And even the assets that are built on top of large language models from game companies will be disconnected from the internet. It will be inside a box that will never spill out on the internet, and they will have an inherent advantage forever based on the 25 years of content that they've made, you know? So this is the future. It's not even going to be a thing that you'll, like, most people will know. It won't be shared. It's going to be, like, I think, industry secret. So everything shared is going to be, like, a race to the bottom, generalized. And all the good stuff is going to be very, very kept close to the chest.
That almost sounds like you're saying, like, 10 to 20 person teams within big companies that have, like, historically have, like, a lot of resources and have a lot of IP, have a lot of, like, more manually created, like, creative talent, are able to generate these proprietary models that they can then use to, like, create new things faster that are high quality.
Yes, that. And also for new startups, they will make a thing with AI that's very bespoke to the thing that they're very good at doing, whatever it is,
sure,
that is blue ocean or non-competitive, and be very, very successful. This is going to be, like, I think, a trend.
What kind of team composition do you think you need for that, though? Like, do you think now people are going to build, like, you know, like, foundation layer, like, data people as, like, the starting group? Or, yeah, like, how does a startup actually get to that level? I think with big companies, it's clear, but what's your take on more of the startup side?
I think the big companies have already started to poke into this. I know at least a handful that are doing this already. The small companies, I don't think you start with like a, I don't think you start with that. I think it's something that you, it's because oftentimes what ends up happening is that it becomes a bridge to nowhere and it becomes neither here or there, right? It becomes like, oh, we're building this thing. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, maybe this thing becomes, the pitch becomes like, oh, this thing is something we can sell to other studios. I think it starts with like a very, very coherent vision that is differentiated. And it's like, okay, we're going to build an AI thing that helps us solve this thing at the most, at the, at a competitive advantage level. And there's enough, I would say, bespoke things out there that's not generalized that would be fair game, I guess, for people to do. Yeah. But I think it still starts with game.
To your point about a trend or a bulk of like bespoke efforts, I don't know if this is what you're saying or if this is adjacent or overlapping what you're saying, but I can't help but retain a sense that judgment is still a high quality to preserve, even if there's AI. So especially in this world where, I mean, just take the four of us and our takes on a recent game we played, Helldivers, Pal World, or what our favorite games are, we're going to get like pretty different takes. Now imagine a team of people making a game. Like, you don't just say, hey, AI, make game fun. It will, you know, it's gonna, you're putting it in a position to derive something that's like commonly fun. But like part of, I think someone has been mentioning this to me, and someone mentions this to me, and I thought it was a pretty good take, that is it our jobs as developers to surprise? So almost by definition, and if that's true, almost by definition, must we do something not previously defined in order to like create a diff between what someone would expect and then like hopefully a pleasant surprise or a, you know, difficult challenge? There's like an expectation set. I'm going to go in this game to play this thing. And then there's like a, oh shit, it's harder than I thought. Oh shit, this is like, you know, I didn't think this, you could do this in this game. And I think it's our jobs is to create a diff. Now I don't know really enough about AI to know if like you can force an AI to look for those diffs, and if even if it does it, is it random versus like tastefully done? But I can't help but feel like judgment is a major component of this in our field, and I would argue for as long as we can see, but you know, I don't want to say it. So
look, I am the first person that would tell you like art can't be made in a factory, right? Factories make McDonald's. To me, like, there's a heart and soul to game making or any sort of creative endeavor that has to come through in that way. And I think AI doesn't solve for that. There's no way. And so I don't think of AI as being, this is why I say like the stuff that's going to be out in the market, the stuff that's for everyone, is going to start to be a race to the bottom. It's going to feel like the stuff that you've seen before, you can't be surprised by it. This is why I think a lot of teams will start to be, hey, this is like the thing that we do and we do it really, really well. And it's actually like, and I think of AI as like way beyond generation, right? It's all kinds of other stuff. I remember like playing Diablo 2, and I'm such a huge fan of that game, and the sort of the loot code is like legendary, you know, it's like the most addictive loot code ever. And it, even in the subsequent ones, the loot code doesn't feel quite as good. Right. We've talked about this before. And so to me, there's an aspect of design that you can't really even replicate it, even if you may actually have a team that's just as good. Right. And so, and that's all I'm saying. I'm saying like, there's a thing that comes to mind, which is like, oftentimes when we try to go for the masses, we have to seek average. The masses seek average. And if you think about like big studios who are trying to reach the largest amount of audience, in some ways they have to like seek the average. They have to seek a lower common denominator to acquire those users. And so AI is a little bit like that, right? AI seeks average. And so it can only build new things with old bricks. And so there, but I think there are ways. That's why AIG is so interesting. Yeah. or is it AGI? It's one of those. But I think the creator is still central. This is why I don't think, to Brian's point earlier, I don't think you build a sort of tech company and around like a game. Like I think you build a game, you build a piece of art.
I mean, here's the point. Like a bunch of us said earlier, like 10 to 15 people, you can create a $1 billion game. And I think the point is not that any 10 to 15 person team can do that. It's like a very specific 10 to 15 person team. Just like I think tooling and animation has gotten much better over the last 15 years. Doesn't mean that anybody with a text prompt can create a Pixar movie, right? Like if anything, it's like even harder today to create high quality animation than it was 10, 15 years ago, even though a lot more people can do it. And I think that's the trap that we often fall into as investors, where like new technology comes out, and just because it enables something to be able to be done, doesn't mean that that thing is going to be done more. And so the supply side is going to increase dramatically for all of these different creative mediums. But then it becomes even more important in this world with a million times more content. Like what is actually good, sustainable content that people want to keep coming back to for thousands of hours? And I do think technology is going to help like smaller teams do more. But it doesn't mean that just because you're a small team, you're going to be successful because of the technology.
Yeah, arguably, we already have infinite content. There's infinite shows and infinite movies and infinite games like that are shipped. And only there's like a beauty to what rises to the top. And I think uniquely within games, I found, and maybe there's like an exception here, but great games will always find their audience. And that's actually a universal rule that isn't true in other mediums. You know, you can look at music and like an incredible musician can be playing in the subway and no one would even recognize because there's a gatekeeper that allows someone to become a famous artist. Or in the film business, like you can spend a lot of money on marketing to promote a film for first weekend, you know, even though the film is like, you know, RT like 27 or something. But in games, I think uniquely great games will somehow find its niche and find its audience and eventually find a place. And so I think it's a very unique thing for our industry.
What about on the gameplay side? Like we talked a lot about tooling, efficiency. Have you guys seen anything like more unique to like gameplay? People trying to create like agent games or, you know, AI powered games that again, isn't just like like a better Dungeon Master D&D thing, but actual like new type of
gameplay. There's a bunch of things that I think don't need to be reinvented. There's this thing that I've been wrestling with over the last, I don't know, say 10 years where I noticed like, you know, the word innovation gets used a lot. And of course we want things to be innovative, new, fresh. But I think there's a line that you can cross. And that line is pretty shallow, I think, where if you cross that line, it gets into like unfamiliar. And unfamiliar is interpreted as weird versus innovative. Versus positive. And if that's the player's response that is evoked, they're not going to blame themselves. They're going to blame us, the creator. So I've kind of learned over time that like there's like a certain amount that like you can deviate from the norm. And I think certain things like control scheme. Like imagine if every game, this is taken to extreme, but imagine every game you don't use WASD. It's like some other combo. Very appropriate and very like bespoke to that game. And you're like, okay, cool. I don't know how to play this game. I have to go to the tutorial for every new game. It's like so much friction, right? Whereas like you can pretty reliably like walk up to a game, hit WASD and have a reasonable idea what's going to happen next. And I think there's certain things that have kind of like settled to where there are best practices for some things. Now there's too much and too little of everything. Like some people I think go too far with that notion and think, there's best practices for everything and how to make a game. And if you do this formula, like it'll pump out and work. And I think clearly there's ample evidence that like a lot formulas don't work for the majority of games. Formulas work for, I think, certain games. And so I think having maybe tools that standardize the first like leg of making a game, I think will continue to develop and be useful. So one thing I kind of lament is looking across, you know, you guys have more visibility than I do, but let's say I look across like about 100 gaming startups or so that I can see in the West Coast here. I see many, many teams, ourselves included, spending a lot of our funding on just the first like 20% of the game we hope for or envision. And many of us are taking those same steps, and we all have to make the controls responsive, and we have to like reinvent it. So I wonder if, like, you know, tools like Unreal or Unity can increase the floor of that for over time. And I think that will continue to help us skip past those initial steps and then spend more of our time and funding and energy on the part, that layer that's innovative. Whereas right now, I think a lot of what we're seeing is like people spent their seed instead of the concept on creating that same initial floor that looks like 20 other startups. And then it's really hard to differentiate or to interpret what was made and extrapolate like what will be made, because you're still, hopes and dreams are the same as when you asked us for money the last time. And what I'm looking at looks like, okay, and I don't know how to read this. And I think that's like a really precarious position to be in. So I hope that like AI tools, continued development of like Unreal and Unity help us to get more, even more past those initial steps. They already go so much of the bulk of the way there, but I wonder if like more can be done there so that we can spend more of energy and time on like our value prop instead of like the basic stuff that everyone has to do. They definitely already do the gross amount of like heavy lifting.
Yeah.
But yet I look across so many startups and we all like kind of did the same amount of like work for like many months or maybe even a year, you know.
Yeah,
I'm not quite sure.
No, what for sure. But data, I think, I think the nuance is like from a controls perspective is still actually very, very important, because again, that's kind of where you make the feel and the differentiation happen.
That's true too. I mean, but part of that maybe is necessary to get there. Yeah.
I think part of it, last time we talked about like, someone said, I think, it was a NVIDIA CEO. He said, English is the new programming language. I think he said that. And I was like, I thought that was a pretty profound thing to say, which is like, everybody's going to be a programmer. You speak English, you talk to the prompt, and you're programming now. And I think there's something kind of profound about the idea that, because any kind of like sort of baseline controls, baseline movement, UI, gameplay is going to require a level of engineering, right, to put together. And if you can, you can get that down to a place where people can prototype just by, again, his vision is that at some point everybody's gonna be able to do that. Then you can get a lot of prototyping done very quickly by doing stuff like that. Yeah.
I guess what are your thoughts on, we talked a little on indie versus AAA, and I think part of the challenge of swinging big has to do with like, if you raise like $30 to $50 million before you ship your game, like you have to build a certain size business around your game. Whereas I think we talked about Valheim and Pow World, much smaller teams, even if they took a long time, like not a lot of capital went into shipping this game. So even if they make $100 million, $150 million, that's a great outcome for them, but potentially not venture fundable. I think one thing we have to think a lot about on the investment side is like, what is the actual business case for what is being built? And should the studio, should it be more of part of a game publisher that is just churning out new titles that can generate some kind of predictable revenue for the publisher? Or is this something that could be kind of venture fundable? How do you see kind of that evolving as like, whether it's like tooling or advancements in technology and to change what it means to make a game?
I think the verdict is like still out, or jury's still out, I forgot how you say that, on venture capital and gaming. And I like hesitate to say that out loud because intuitively, more money in, more energy in, more shots on goal, I think has been an enormously good thing for innovation and teams striking out clearly over the past like few years. But when we're waiting for like, I guess the results of that in a lot of ways, a lot of these things that have succeeded in the past year, you know, like your Baldur's Gate 3 and your Helldivers and Pow World, like as far as I know, these were not like venture funded things. So I don't think they count towards like these efforts. You know, there's things that we can try to mimic or analyze or case study, but I think in general we're wanting to see how we can get this to work. I think we all have a vested interest in it working. We really want it to continue with the energy and the interest to continue, but there might be some dissonance to figure out in terms of expectations, in terms of sizing. I love that these small examples of smaller scopes exist and are inspiring, and maybe there's something there where, I mean, push comes to, if you like press me for an answer, like which one I'm more excited about, I think I have to say the smaller bets make a lot more sense in terms of something that you can work with. Whereas I think all of us with bigger funding, ourselves included, will feel potentially a counterproductive stress of like a commensurate, like bigger outcome, which is, I think, a totally fair ask. But when you have it at the earliest stages, and I think both a conscious and subconscious level affects your decision-making to be more conservative, which might be precisely counterproductive to the hope that we all like are venturing out for. Because otherwise, why didn't we just all stay at our bigger companies to have basically more funding than that? Why didn't we do that? You know, like, and I think that's a question like for a lot of us founders to wrestle with that did manage to raise more. And I wrestle with it all the time personally. And I don't know if I'm less alone in that, but like, but it was a lot of our proposition of why we even wanted to make something outside of a bigger company was for the freedom of doing something without a gun to your head to do it a certain way. And I don't know yet, and we'll see if we have really taken advantage of that prospect. Are we really making games that couldn't have been done, shouldn't have been done at a bigger place? I think is something that all of us who raised more like should be wrestling with. And if it was about like big funding equals big game, even as much as we raise, it's nothing compared to the amount of some money we spent at our bigger companies making those things. So it's like this awkward medium that we're that some of us are in. Yet there's been a nice steady flow of games with like smaller budgets that have been blowing up. Like look at Dark and Darker as like another example. I know they're in like, you know, they've had their legal troubles separately, but their initial playtest shipped after having spent $1.5 million. And I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? Just like relative to that, like I know right now we're like, you know, conservative relative to some of the other teams, but like we're not that conservative. We're not running like an actual startup, you know, like showing actual product traction with the thinnest of investments to prove the concept. Now, quickly following after that is all the other next questions of like, is it scalable? Are they able to keep up with their service? And like, then they struggle, you know, like a lot of teams have struggled with that. You know, you look at like, even with the success of like Valheim's Among Us, those get thrown in now into like this 2020 hindsight conversation of like, yeah, they blew up. And then like, they didn't do anything with it. And then like, they get criticized for that. And so we all want our cake and eat it too. We all want fast wins, but like the big companies, the bigger funded companies and startups, you know, we'll get criticized for like, are you operating like a startup? And like, are you just keep bringing in your habits from the bigger companies? And then the little companies get criticized for like, can you follow up on your success? And like, are you dropping the ball? And like, it's just like freaking, how hard do we want to make this? It's like, so, the questions I think are legitimate. And I think they should get asked and we should wrestle with them. But like anything, there's like too much and too little. So like, you know, a company that gets no pressure just waddles around for like 10 years and may or may not produce anything, like no one wants that. And then I think there is like a too much where like it actually affects the decision making and could potentially be counterproductive to like the hope and the goal and the risk taking. And like, are you actually pushing somewhere or taking a risk here? Or are you like so scared, like you pull all the way back? And if you are pulling back, then why don't you just make this game at like a bigger company then and without the stress of like a next funding?
No, I think it's a great question. I think if you're making anything that is going to be a legend or great, there will always be naysayers because you're inherently rocking the status quo. You're going against some grain. That's why it stands out. That's why it's great. You made the thing that everybody knows is going to come. It's not going to be great. It's not going to be remembered, right? And so there's like a famous sort of saying, which is like, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then they love you.
And then they copy you or whatever.
And then they copy you. But I think your question around the sort of VC landscape and whatnot, I think the industry is going, capital is going to figure out ways to flow in the right mechanism. And I think it's always very difficult to capture and fund creative work, art, right? Now, if you look at the film industry, right? The film industry has no VCs, right? It's all finance in all kinds of weird ways. And, you know, you can look at film as being like a 9 month to 3 year process of like raising and creating a company and then spinning it down, you know, for every film, actually, even if you're at a studio, you're doing it as a separate company for every film. If you're writing a book, like it doesn't get VC funded. If you're drawing, if you're in the modern art business, it's not VC funded. And so the VC funding vehicle is like very much like sort of like tech, enterprise software, Silicon Valley, you know, sort of mentality. And games just happen to fall into this very interesting niche, which has both the tech aspects, the technology aspects, the sort of SaaS business model, you know, games as a service or subscription. And so it has all that, but it also has the creativity, the art, the IP, all that. And so I think, you know, with so many funds in the last few years raising large amounts of money to figure this out, and I think it's a good thing because what is it? Like, and at some point it's going to fall into an interesting sort of like, you know, is VC the final form? I don't think so, right? It's going to be some hybrid, right? Because you can see that even within the major game companies like the EAs, the Ubisoft, the, you know, like the sort of internal investments in new games, it's hit or miss or it's non-existent, right? Like a lot of these companies won't do it. And some companies will do it, but only if you're making something that's sort of relatively safe and already has a market, et cetera. But again, when you're at a certain size, the average has to accrue average to get the biggest audience. And therein lies the interesting rub, which is like VC has to go somewhere and it doesn't really go into indie games because indie games don't really have that giant outsized reward necessarily. And I think what $100 million is great, right? But again, oftentimes VC capital wants something more sustaining and larger. And so I think it's going to figure out its path. And again, it may be a hybrid of what we're all seeing because, you know, internal companies, large companies are still investing in their internal teams. Some are, some aren't. But I think it comes down to like, how do you fund art? I mean, that's a fundamental question. How do you fund something that is inherently creative, even if it has like a service-based model of making that looks like a lot like enterprise software or something? And so I think it's going to figure out its way. And with AI, with blockchain, with all these new different things, with VR, AR, like something is going to emerge, you know? And I think it's going to be like, and actually, to be honest, like me personally, I think it's a beautiful thing. I think it's a beautiful thing that there's VCs that are doing like and investing in like people trying to create their dreams, trying to do something innovative. I think it's a beautiful thing when Riot and Blizzard and these companies are like, hey, we want to go and make the next, you know, League of Legends or Valorant or whatever it is, or World of Warcraft, right? And I think it's a beautiful thing that in the East, they have like, I saw an MMO that's coming out of China that was made for $12 million and it looks amazing. Like, and, you know, so I'm just like, look, I think it's a beautiful thing. And I think that's what makes games so unique. It could be anything. It could be like idle cookie clicker to big MMO to like, you know, like those like point and click adventures on freaking like, you know, iPhone. Like it's everything in between and there's models for all. And that's why I think the game industry is so interesting. It's going to keep growing. You know, the hardest thing about being a capital allocator in this market is actually being current. Because it's not like if I was funding like a film, right? I can go and watch the director and every movie he's made. But if I was funding like you know, at Haveli, we just did that the big Jagex deal, right? Like the and it's not like it's like how do you because many times like if you said, hey, evaluate this game, that game is 10,000 hours to really understand it. That's not like, I'm going to watch it over the weekend. That's like, let me spend the next 2 years, 4 hours a day playing this game. You know, like that's the difference. And I think if you're new and you're just like, oh, I have money, but I don't know what to invest in, I think it's actually a really daunting task because you cannot make heads or tails of why something works, something doesn't work. There's an inherent growth that, I mean, I think for us, we're in that generation where, you know, I grew up with Atari 2600. I'm sure many of you started with Nintendo or Game Boy or something. Like, we grew up with games. We played every game growing up. Like, I'm sure all of us on this call played everything. So we had this like inherent history of growing up with it. But if you're new, or you're new to like, if you're like from another industry and you're like, I want to do games. Like, I'm like, whoa, like, I want to invest in games. I'd be like, where do you even start? Like, what game should you start? Because every game's going to take you like 50 hours to just play. And then how do you compare it to any other game? You know, like, so I think to your question is a great question. You know, I've sort of wrestled with it. You can kind of tell I'm wrestling it in my mind right now, but it's like, it's not like any industry. And I'm glad there's a VC market. I'm actually glad, like with Haveli, there's like a private equity market, you know? But I think it's going to change and evolve and grow, and it's going to be a beautiful thing. And that's what makes games so great.
Well, that's what keeps us challenged, right? And having to, I think, constantly like have a new problem to solve. And I mean, to me, I can't help but like treat it like its own game. I don't know if that's what it should be, but that's what it's like, another set of challenges and another, like, no one really knows the right build. And, you know, it's like we're kind of in that zone right now. And as soon as someone does, a game gets all min-maxed and it's all formulaic, like you see all these other branches forming. And it's part of, I think, what makes this industry like fun and scary at the same time.
Well, I think it's actually very nuanced. Like, the decisions that you make, thousands of decisions that you make for your game or any game, it's like, it's very nuanced. And I think in many ways, experience is both like a blessing and a curse, right? And so it's really interesting as you guys are evaluating founders, and, you know, we obviously know many of them. It's really fascinating to see like who comes from what and what's that secret sauce. I think a lot of the whys of people making whatever they're making is actually really important. Like, the reasons behind their intent is actually really important.
What are some things coming out of GDC, like some blue ocean spaces you guys are personally kind of excited about, or like some games coming up that you're looking forward to? And we'll close with that.
I don't know if there's any that I can actually talk about. that you know, like, and it's not like they're like invisible, but I think oftentimes it's like a friend EA.
or just games that recently came out that have been successful that you think is like they brought something new to the market, or
You know, I think the whole Helldivers 2 has been very, very eye-opening because of, you know, like it a sequel that departs from its camera angle, which is like in essentially a new game, like a new game style. And it blew up super hard. Like, I think that's an incredible achievement for a team to do so. So that's been actually really cool. You know, I think the other one that, you know, I think Brian, either Brian or Jason, one of you guys talked about, which is Final Fantasy, the remake. Although what it looks like, a very expertly done execution, right, hasn't sort of captured the audience they wanted, I think. And so that's like sort of two very surprising sort of things. Like, I sort of, you know, the whole idea of remakes is a very interesting thing. You know, you see the Last of Us remakes. There's a lot of companies doing remakes now, and it's sort of like the game industry is old enough now that we can do remakes. You know, the technology jump is far enough that it's actually pretty fascinating. Like, you see this in other industries, but games is obviously different because of technology and business model and whatnot. And so I find that trend to be fascinating. I sort of want to dig into figuring out like why a remake works and why a remake doesn't work, you know. That to me is a fascinating conversation to have.
I don't know if this is like a similar but tangential similar take about like what's old is new again. So for me, like, I know like time is like, you know, passing by so quickly, but I'm still like bullish about like Dark and Darker. I think there's a lot more that they can take that game to from the foundation that they have. I think they hopefully are on the cusp of overcoming a lot of their like legal challenges that hold them back currently. I'm actually, I don't know if this is good or bad, but I'm still on the, like the Tarkov train. It's like, they obviously have like a really solid game that has inspired a lot of like now extraction shooter propositions. But there's so many places they can take that game from that foundation. They did a lot of the hard work already, and there's so many things that they can do with it now that they've earned. Whether or not they will is like, you know, anyone's guess. But I do think that some of those games had a very hard-earned start that I think from that foundation, like a lot of new experiences can be derived from them by those developers, let alone others. So I'm still really bullish about some of those games that, you know, like we've talked about before or seem like they came and went, but they still have very, very strong followings and they don't have to stagnate at all. And I know like, I know for sure the Dark and Darker team isn't. I'm not as familiar with the Tarkov team, although I might have a chance to speak with them soon. But I'm still really bullish about some of the existing games that have so much more they can build and take their games to, versus like the next new offering that, you know, it's exciting for like a month and then like, what happened to that thing? Like, you know, everyone was playing Balatro like a month ago. Like before I could even get in there, like it's already over. And I'm like, I don't know. But that's like fine. You know, it's like not to be expected for a game like that, but it's just like, I think inspiring things doesn't have to be only the newest, latest thing. I think it's easy to take for granted the things that people can build from, like that were already like had legs.
Yeah, you know, like the Analog Pocket that you guys showed us and gifted to us at GDC. I pulled out my old Final Fantasy 3, you know, or Final Fantasy 6. And my kids' homework over spring break is to finish that game. Like, that to me is like it brings back such a, because it's one of my favorite games, right? Yeah. But if you think about it, right, like that game's probably like a few hundred hours. Tarkov is many thousands of hours. Dark and Darker is many thousands of hours. Helldivers is many hundreds of hours. You know, all the games we spoke of are hundreds, if not thousands of hours. Like, think about, if somebody wanted to get into the nuance of actually talking about any of these games in detail, like, it doesn't happen. This is why it's such an interesting industry. Like, how, as a capital allocator, are you fully up to date, aware, and understand? How does a developer get fully up aware and fully aware 360? It's like, you're not even working at that point. You're just playing games, right?
I knew everyone was full of shit when I played. You know, everyone's doing their hot takes on Power World, and I know you guys wanted us to say something about it, but I was like, I don't need to add to this because I played only 20 hours and I unlocked 90% of the pals.
Yeah.
And I saw in the Steam achievement that only 3% of the audience unlocked that. So I was like,
got that far.
Nobody couldn't even be bothered to play this game for 20 hours with their hot takes. Like, what the heck? And so I'm like, you know, it's dumb.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel like also it's like an age thing, right? I just realized FF7, the original, was released like 30 years ago. It's crazy to think about it that way. I'm personally like pretty excited by 1997. But I think, I don't know how you guys feel, but I feel like a lot of the stuff that's coming out on the AAA side, it's kind of like we've played these games before, right? Like even like GTA. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be incredible.
But I mean, I think that's why there's something there to figure out on. Actually, it's not even, it's mostly actually on the established studios. Like we've pumped these things to such high stakes, such big teams. It just makes everyone like retreat back into like the known as if it's safer. But is it safe to like make this 35th battle royale? Like, I don't think so. I'd argue that that's like one of the most dangerous things you can do. But it feels safe in the moment, or as you go through and establish your like green light process and everything. And I think it's an illusion of safety that actually holds us back.
I wish like there's going to be, do you guys remember, again, we're kind of, all of us are dating ourselves, but like Ultima Online, I remember when I first logged on that thing, I was like blown away. Cause it's like the first, that was like, I never played the MUDs, but I played Ultima Online. I was like, holy shit, this is like a new thing, right? Like it was like super exciting to actually experience like a new type of game that couldn't have been done before, and probably Diablo 2, like with Battle.net. But I guess
in
like
that way, maybe we got really lucky growing up, you know, like we got a lot of firsts.
But I hope there's more of that. Like I'm actually looking forward to that stuff from startups that can actually create these new type of things. And again, I just think like it's going to happen again. Like maybe it's like something in blockchain or like eventually AR, VR, maybe it's a generative AI. Like there's a lot of NPC agent startups, obviously, that are being spun up. But I guess that's like the thing I'm looking forward to is just like, what's kind of next? Like what's that moment where you like log on to Ultima Online, you're like, holy shit, this is way different than anything we've played, right? Like
I didn't know I needed this in my life, but I need it for 10,000 hours. Yeah.
I mean, when's the last game that made you guys feel that way, like without having to go that far back? Like for me, it was Tarkov, and it wasn't like people go quick right away to like, oh, it's like permanent loot loss. That was definitely part of the formula, but for me, ultimately, the heart of it was I had not ever felt stakes that high in a game. I never cared that much to try that hard in a game every night, every match. You know, there were bits of that. I would say there was that, but at a relatively lower bar, but relatively higher bar to existing games with like your Counter-Strike, your Dota, League of Legends, and Valorant, I think are all like a similar high stakes level. And those might be like 10 times the stakes that you feel in like, I don't know, WoW questing, or I'll pick on like Call of Duty multiplayer is like specifically designed to be like casual. And there's a lot of value to that, but the stakes are really low by design. And so you have these other games that feel relatively like high stakes. And then after that is normalized for like a decade, finding, and against all odds, against all like, all odds and also all peer pressure, a small group of Russians made this game that's like even higher stakes that I feel like in a way that only a bunch of Russians could and like a bunch of Westerners wouldn't. And then they're like, it has every reason to not succeed. And if you talk to anyone making an extraction shooter, they have their laundry list of like 30 things of what they're going to fix. And I'm like, yet every night I come crawling back to this game because it's the only place I can get that experience that blows my mind every night, you know, different in a different way than that first time seeing a graphical interface or multiplayer in a thing, but to a similar effect where I keep coming back. And so, yeah, like for me, it was Tarkov over the last 4 years. And before that, probably Monster Hunter, like really surprised me. Monster Hunter has really opened my eyes to what a loot table and crafting system integration could be, to the degree that I don't feel anything anymore. And like, I feel like it has, for me, deprecated a pure RNG system like you get in Diablo or in WoW. Like they blend like RNG a bit with crafting agency. And once I felt that, I'm like, I can't go back to a pure RNG system anymore. So for me, that was like a revolutionary experience for me. And I stepped in late. I stepped in like in the third version, but as an experience, I'm like, this thing exists. Like I didn't even think there was something better than the RNG loot chase until I saw that. And that's highly influential now in a lot of the games or in our new game that we're approaching. But yeah, I'm curious what for you guys, like after UO, like, was there anything that made you like think of everything differently, or like you found yourself like crawling back?
For me, it was probably Demon's Souls. Just like, you know, growing up in the Nintendo, I grew up in the NES era where like games are super hard, right? And you just kind of keep playing it to do well. And I remember early in my career, we actually looked at that game as like a potential publishing deal, and everyone passed on it basically. Cause like people basically said it was going to be like, no one would want the game. It was like way
too hard. The theme is too dark. It's way too hard. This game's going to be too niche. Like,
yeah. Right. And ended up being game of the year, I think, like way back. But I think things like that, I think it's to your original point. It's like, I think when developers take risks, like good things can come out of it. Now, like The Souls and Elden Ring, like that's like a multi-billion dollar franchise, right? Because From Software was willing to like throw down the gauntlet and take that creative risk and actually go after gamers that, you know, probably didn't exist before. So
and Demon's Souls was like a build-up. Like it didn't jump straight to that.
Oh, no, yeah.
It was a build-up from three or four versions or whatever, yeah.
Right, right. And Elden Ring was just like, it took four games to get there, but it's probably one of the best games ever made, right? So
a lot of people forget, like, you know, just like League, it was a build-up. It was a long build-up.
How about for you, Thomas? Do you have any games that pop up?
Oh my gosh. I mean, over the history of games, definitely, like, we talked about many of the usual suspects, right? I spent, like, 8 years playing WoW. You know, like, I still think, like, some of my favorite moments were, like, Arena, right? Like, those moments still haven't even been captured today, you know? Going 2v2, 3v3s, you know, Battlegrounds, Alderac Valley. Like, these experiences are, like, just amazing. Like, even, like, the rating in WoW, right? Like, 40-person raids, like, where, how do you capture that? Like, you know, before that, there was Dayok and the three-person, sort of three-party raids that happened to control, like, the different points where dungeons would open. Like, there's so many things in the olden days that still haven't been replicated, even today, you know? It's like, in many ways, games have regressed weirdly, you know, from a fantasy fulfillment perspective. Like, you know, and it's weird because I like I said, it's like the masses seek average. And as the game industry got larger, the games got more average to accrue more masses. You know, there's this like theory, which I thought was very interesting, which is like the English language, if you go back like 200 years, you can barely read it because the way they use words was so different, was actually quite elevated. But now everybody wants to write books that anybody can read. And so the words, like you kind of have to write at a fifth grade level, you know, for the masses. And so it's like weird, like this weird, like domestication of our intellect. And I think it happens across the board. Like we talk about, you know, sometimes Slim and I talked about like films and why are films like kind of dumbed down now versus like something that was like much more elevated back in the day. And so I think that's happening across the board. And it's sort of like, how do we get back to that state? How do we become and do some of those things that games of yesteryear does? That's why I think maybe Tarkov is so delightful for Slim, because it's so uncompromising. You know, DayZ was uncompromising. Rust was uncompromising. You know, these games just did things that it's not for the masses. And League of Legends started out not for the masses.
Yeah.
I don't think Brandon Mark was like, oh, this is gonna be
a that's probably a good point to close on. And for me personally, that was probably the first game that I spent like thousands of hours, not only playing, but like consuming all the other content around League of Legends. And League didn't start off with 100 million players, right? Like League started off with like 500, 1,000, 10,000. And it had to like resonate with that like audience that was very hardcore, and every VC and every investor thought was like way too niche and it wasn't interesting to go after. But then like over a very long period of time, obviously it was able to extend into like other players that didn't originally play Dota. And I think that's the thing, that you have to be able to resonate deeply with a specific audience that then allows the game to grow into like other communities that those players like want to play games with. If you try to go after 100 million players right away and say, I'm going to compete with Fortnite or Valorant or League, that's almost like impossible from the beginning. And yet, I think that's something that a lot of people have been kind of chasing.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think throughout my life, there's so many games that impacted, and so many games have done things that today, you know, RuneScape, which now I'm close to, they do things in there that no one else does. Like, a quest in WoW is like, go and kill three pigs and come back to town. A quest in RuneScape is like, go and deliver the ring to Mount Doom. It's like a 12-hour epic, you know? Like, it's like, right? Like, it's just people don't do this because it's harder and it's more commitment. And, you know, they have great numbers. And I think a lot of people are seeking that kind of like bespoke, unique experiences. And I think a lot of teams, I think, struggle with this because they're trying to get a gigantic audience. And and so they have to really...
They go straight to hard vanilla, basically, and they just become really normie.
They just have
really
to distill it down into, like, something that's, like, you know, I mean, like match three, you know, or something like that, you know? It's like at some games, at some point, every game is match three now.
Yeah.
You know, like, but you get my point. Like, throughout the history of games, there's like these experiences, these moments, like going out into the wilderness in RuneScape, or even like something like Slay the Spire or Hades. Like, I thought these games were excellent games that did something unique and different. Darkest Dungeon. Oftentimes, you know, you'll find these, when I played Firewatch, like it was, or Edith Finch, like I think a lot of, like, you know, Annapurna is one of my favorite studios, because every time they make something, I actually feel like the connective tissue to something in the soul, right? Like Stray is a game about a freaking cat. And that, I think that game did like 400 million. You know, like, to me, like that's where it becomes elevated, it becomes art, it becomes differentiated, it becomes like something that I can like connect to and pull from and remind myself why I want to play games, you know? Like, even back in the day, like, you know, like when Psycho Mantis like freaking turned off my game, right? Like in Metal Gear, right? Or they did the same thing like with Eternal Darkness, right? Like, these are games that did things that are like, wait, you know, like some talk about games that sort of are unexpected, right? Like,
I can't help but like, as you guys are recounting all this, like, is that the common thing? Like, we have, is it our jobs to, for some group of people to establish a norm so that some group of us can break from the norm, and then it's like a endless cycle for, yeah, like
it's a universal law. Yeah. It's a universal law.
I wonder.
It's a universal law. And like, it's the, to me, it's a universal law. Like that's why the average seeks averages. So the exceptional needs to be against that grain.
But the thing that's different, it's hard to get past that initial step for a lot of people who want to do something different, because it's not fundable. Like, well, it doesn't sound fundable.
It's also,
right?
The money thing too, right? People want to, publishers usually bet on very safe bets, and big companies too, because like they kind of have to, right? They know their audience. But I do think that's where the startups have an edge, is they can actually really go out of the norms and do crazy stuff. And yeah, I wish, like, personally, I wish there were more, like, Hideo Kojimas, right? Like, stuff he creates is, like, super out there, but it's, like, incredible. Like, I love Death Stranding. I'm probably one of the few people that actually, like, beat the game. Well, that's an incredible game for me.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah. Oh, for sure. Like,
you missed out on your other life as an Uber driver.
UPS driver,
it's
man.
Like, a DoorDash driver.
Well, think about, like, the guy, Slim's talking about Monster Hunter, right? I want to say his name wrong.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. But yeah,
like the creator of it. Like his background is like Street Fighter 2, Resident Evil, right? We went from a fighting game to a horror game, zombie horror game, to Monster Strike, which is a mobile game, to Monster Hunter, which is like a sort of like multiplayer sort of MMO monster. Like that. Look at that track record. That's like a history of like unique experiences that are like world class.
He's also, it sounds like he's challenging himself in that also.
Yeah. Look at Miyamoto over at, like, you know, over at Nintendo, right? Like those guys, Nintendo, they just create new genres. Like, let's make a kart rider. Okay, cool. World class. Let's make Smash Brothers. World class. A fighting game. Let's make, like, you know, Pikmin. Let's make, open world sandbox game, Breath of the Wild, world class. Like, these guys, I mean, like, there's a differentiated ability to differentiate, think, that's not in the box at all, and they've cultivated that as part of their organization. I mean, like, I put Nintendo as being like the goat of goats. Like, they just create genres and dominate.
Yeah.
They create hardware and dominate. Hardware is freaking hard, right? Like, these guys are the best.
Yeah.
The best of the
best. I don't think, actually, you know, a lot of people argue games are hits-driven. I actually disagree, right? Because if you look at, like, the track record of some of these, like, game designers and developers, like, the good ones, it's pretty incredible in terms of what they're able to ship and, yeah, and do it over time and time again. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. I would never bet against these gentlemen and people, so...
Cool. Yeah. Well, thank you guys very much. I know we're running super late, and I think Slim has to get on the road. So.